Can't you see it? The world powered by solar and renewable energy. Here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Hey guys, it's Jim Costa from Cash the Ticket. If you're betting the NFL playoffs, you need to be listening to Cash the Ticket. We're breaking down every single game, totals and sides, all the way to the big game. Subscribe to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Matt was about to unleash a take on Wicked, man, and I'm dying to hear it. Go ahead.
I unknowingly watched Wicked on Broadway in New York. I knew that part, but I unknowingly realized later when I found the playbill years later, but that Idina Menzel was playing. Idina Menzel, that's what made her famous, is Wicked.
How long ago was that?
I was in middle school, I think.
Oh, wow. That's pretty dope.
Yeah, it was crazy.
That's pretty dope. They actually, the Glinda and Alphaba make the original Broadway. They make appearances in the movie, which is
pretty dope.
There's a lot of really cool little Easter eggs in the movie. Like, if you know the story, there's like, and obviously if you know the story, but if you know the Wizard of Oz, there's like little breadcrumbs. It's like, I know what happens to you. Like that happens through the whole movie.
So is it like a prequel?
Yeah, it's like attempting to tell the story of evil. Like how the Wicked Witch became the Wicked Witch. Mm-hmm. And well, like mostly everything, it's racism. So you go watch it and no, she's ostracized because she's different.
Yeah.
And then it leads to, she realizes she has these powers, and it just leads to where we're at when some people who didn't know this, and I feel bad for them, watched 2 hours and 40 minutes and didn't get a conclusion. You got to be continued.
First act.
Part two is next year.
But ruin a wholesome movie.
Yeah, but the scene, the end of the end of the act one is just like iconic, because the end of the movie on the big screen, what everyone's watching, that's the end of act one on the play. And it's one of the most iconic scenes from the play. But I loved it. Like, I love The Wizard of Oz. I love that whole story. And Wicked is my favorite Broadway play that I've ever seen. So I enjoyed the movie a lot.
Before we talk Kings, can I share with you what my Christmas present was from my wife? And you're both going to roll your eyes at it, but I'm very excited about it.
I don't think I will, but go ahead.
In May, we are going to, I don't remember the actual name of it, but the Orchestra Symphony Hall in San Francisco, where we will watch a Lord of the Rings movie and the orchestra and choir will perform the score of the movie while we're watching.
That's awesome.
That is
I'm so fired up. It's expensive as hell, though.
That's all right.
That's really dope.
Like KC says, you're not going to miss the money.
Nah.
So it's fine.
You're not.
Well,
do what you got to do.
Are you going to miss Mike Brown, though? That's the real question. A lot has happened since we last talked. Kings have won a couple in a row under Doug Christie. And that's the story. Doug Christie is the head coach. Mike Brown was let go. I know we've talked privately about this a ton. You've had Locked On Kings podcast. KC was on ABC this weekend. Let's start here before we backtrack. How do you feel after last night's win? A couple of wins in a row for Sacramento. How do you feel after they were able to string together a couple of wins?
Yeah, what I've been able to do, which is, I guess, hard for some people to comprehend or wrap their brain around, is separate the feelings for Mike Brown with the feelings for Doug, right? Because there's no way that being pro Mike Brown and adamantly against Mike Brown being fired has anything to do with Doug Christie and the love that Sacramento has for that man and the desire to see that man succeed. Mm-hmm. And I've said it multiple times since Mike Brown's firing, I would rather be dead wrong about Mike and Mike is the number one problem of this Kings team, which I absolutely don't believe it's true, but I'd rather be dead wrong about that if Doug succeeded and the Sacramento Kings were good, then I'd rather be right and celebrating losing to prove that I'm right. So last night I thought was a blast. I thought last night the way that game ended, I thought embodied who Doug Christie was as a player, right? And I was watching Doug almost exclusively during the fourth quarter, paying attention to the action too, but my eyes were on Doug, and he was coaching his heart out. He was up. He was active. I clocked when Malik Monk was taking free throws. He pulls over De'Aaron Fox and Domantas Sabonis for a quick chat. That started the 15-0 run. Like, challenged him, said, be aggressive, like, kind of lead by example. That's where the 15-0 run started from that point, if you include the made free throws that Malik made at the time.
I love the idea. I love the idea that Mike pulled De'Aaron and Domas over and said, all right, boys, let's go on a 15-0 run right here and put this in the way.
And they said, no. and then there was the timeout when, after Malik tied the game, the 76ers took a timeout, and right as they're coming back on the floor, Doug grabs all five of them, brings them together, and is fired up, like animated, like, let's get this stop, let's get this win. That's when DeMar DeRozan got the steal. I think his first steal was that play, or maybe it was the second steal. Regardless, like, I just thought the way the Kings played defensively, how they closed out that game, and the activity on the defensive end that led to the offense embodied who Doug was as a player and who Doug was to Sacramento. And it was cool to see the team take on Doug Christie's energy in that moment. So I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed last night. Plus, the Golden 1 Center was extremely loud, and it just had me shaking my head at some point. Of course, I'm biased because I'm one of them. But Kings fans packing that arena when this team has been in turmoil, to say the least, over the last week, and this team is not just bad, they're terrible at home. And that arena sounded like a playoff atmosphere. I mean, it was a really fun, enjoyable night.
You know, I don't know if there's any difference between the two, but you bring up the crowd at the Golden 1 Center, and that caught my attention as well, because I remember going to the game against Indiana after they had lost to the Lakers two times, and that was game four of that five-game homestand, and I just said the morale is low. Like, people were just kind of there to be there. It didn't feel like they were excited or hopeful or anything like that. And I wasn't there the last two nights or last two games. But, man, it certainly felt like everybody was into those games, man. Everybody wanted those wins. It came off really loud on TV, really engaged. And that's good to see. You know, that's good to see, because I talk about, how much the players have gone through as of late, and they've been kind of beaten down. Well, this fan base has been kind of beaten down the last week or so. And, you know, to still want to go out there and see these guys win and be excited for that, I thought that was really cool to see from the people that were in attendance. And salute to them.
Well, Doug is very media savvy from the time that he worked in radio and that he worked in television. So he understands how to play the game. And he definitely knows the words to say, and he also understands this fan base very, very well. So he knows the words to say to inspire the fans. The question's always been, does he know the words to say now to inspire the team to kind of meet that fan energy? And I like how Doug ended his press conference last night after the win. He basically said, every time Kings fans, whether they're leaving the Golden 1 Center, every time Kings fans are finished watching a Kings game, he wants them to say themselves, damn, they played hard, regardless of the result. Mm-hmm. That's what Doug wants. That's what he thinks the fans deserve, but that's what he wants the fans to feel and the fans to see after every single game. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that if we're saying that, more often than not, the Sacramento Kings are probably winning games.
Mm. Matt, so how did we get here then? How did we get here to where Doug is the head coach? Because you laid those things out. And we talked earlier how Doug has a very very calm approach publicly, but he is very just relatable. He's easy to talk to. He's easy to listen to. Like, he's just a very relatable guy. It's why fans have loved him through all of the different roles that he's had for so long here in the city. But what happened with Mike? Like, how did we get to the point where whoever made the decision that it was time to move on from Mike Brown made that decision 30 some odd games into this season?
Well, time will still tell, but for Doug, it may end up being that Doug finally got to the right place, but he got there for the wrong reasons. How did we get here? We got here by the continued incompetence of the organization. All too familiar incompetence of the organization. This is a play out of ownership's playbook that we have seen multiple times, multiple times over the last decade and some change. Since Vivek Ranadive took over the Sacramento Kings, he has had a quick trigger with head coaches, and he has used opportunities to move on prematurely. Now, while the Mike Malone, and sorry to bring that up, Casey, because I know how you feel about Mike Malone, the Mike Malone situation and the Mike Brown situation are not the same thing, but there are parallels. There are parallels to especially the treatment. That's what I'm most disgusted about. I'm most disgusted about the treatment of Mike Brown and how this whole thing went down. To have him coach a practice, to speak to the media, to fire him over the phone on the way to the car. That is embarrassing. That's incompetent. That is insulting. And even if you don't think Mike Brown is your guy, even if you want to ultimately make the decision to fire Mike, I agree with that wholeheartedly to begin with, but to make it worse by doing it the way that you did and not showing Mike the same respect that he is owed, considering he is one of, what, three coaches in the history of Sacramento to actually have any sort of success, the first coach in 12 since Rick Adelman was fired to actually get this team to the playoffs. And that was a year and a half ago, guys. That wasn't 4 years ago. A year and a half ago, this man became the first ever unanimous coach of the year. Now, I understand you have to make decisions based off the present, not based off the past. So you can't make a decision to fire a head coach because of your inability to find the right coaches in the past, or because he won coach of the year a year and a half ago, which, as we've seen, that award can kind of be the kiss of death for coaches.
Not kind of.
It is the kiss of death a lot of times. I understand you don't make decisions based off of that, but that has to play a part. And you have to think about where you've been and where you're trying to go. And does firing Mike Brown sound like what this organization should do to take a step forward? Absolutely not. It sounds like what everybody is recognizing it to be, falling back into all too familiar incompetence. So basketball-wise, time will tell if it was the right decision to get rid of Mike Brown. But how this organization has handled it, and then I know Sean Cunningham has talked about this, James Hamm has talked about this, not putting somebody in front of a microphone or a camera, or forget that, in front of the fans to explain not just why they made that decision, but why they did it the way that they did. It's incompetence. But unfortunately, it is par for the course of this organization. And it is something that I thought the Kings were finally moving past. And it started with day one of Mike Brown stepping into the press conference and preaching about the soul of the organization and all levels have to be on the same page. I felt like Mike, most of the time, was the only guy that wasn't just saying it to say it. Mike was actually putting action behind his words, the accountability. He put action behind it. A lot of players in that locker room, a lot of members of that front office, ownership, I don't think they can say the same.
That's good stuff.
I actually thought you was going to cuss him out.
No, I'm not going to curse him out. No. I mean, like I said, I think Mike Brown is a good coach, man. I just think he left some things to be desired, and there's some things that I think might have rubbed people the wrong way. I think back to that introductory press conference. Do you guys remember who was there? And he talked about how much he loved this dude.
Was it Rashawn?
No, it was Davion.
Oh, Davion. Yeah, Davion. That's what.
We need more guys like Davion. He does this and that, this and that. And then, for whatever reason, Davion just wasn't around after a while. You know,
he got two seasons of context with Davion not holding up his end of the bargain. Davion being a black hole on offense. That's a dumb that's not fair. That's a weird example, because as great as Davion could be defensively, Davion didn't look like he knew how to fit offensively. Now, part of that is on Mike Brown and the coaching staff for sure. But Davion wasn't good enough to be on the floor, I think, enough over the time that he was here in Sacramento. He didn't play well. And we saw Mike Brown pull Davion Mitchell aside in training camp his first year and not call Davion out, but use him as an example to coach up what he was doing wrong. So this was from the beginning.
Do you notice how everybody got a problem? Everybody. Name me one person that Mike Brown hasn't had a problem with. Their play or anything like that. Everybody got a problem. Everybody, don't do this right, don't do that right, don't do this right. Everybody, okay. Name me one person.
Okay, but that's not fair, De'Aaron, too, because Mike Domas, Brown...
He talked about De'Aaron. Publicly, you don't talk about Domas. No. Malik right. got no, into
publicly, he doesn't.
Malik got into it with him a lot.
And he was always the first guy to tell you in a press conference, he was always the first guy to tell you that he and Malik butt heads, but he loves Malik and loves what Malik brings to the team. And Mike has also constantly pointed the finger back to himself over the 3 years. Constantly taken ownership for decisions that he's made. Constantly.
Well, Drew Down brings up a good point. Harrison Barnes never did anything wrong.
But do you? All I'm saying is everybody got a problem. And this is what I talked about when I talked about Doug Christie. And I think this might have been an issue with Mike Brown. It feels like Mike Brown always focused on what people couldn't do. Doug Christie is a person that focuses on what you can do. Somebody, every time somebody was out of the rotation or couldn't play, it's because of what they can't do. And I think that that would rub people the wrong way. That would rub players the wrong way. Everybody always got an issue.
From my perspective, it was Mike Brown not being content with what you are labeled as. So, for example, Malik Monk, you are labeled as an offensive-only player, but I'm going to get something out of you defensively. I think I can hold you to a standard defensively where you can do more. Like, and he felt that way against I'm just using Malik as an example. Mm-hmm. He didn't single Malik out. That's how he was with this. That's how he was with De'Aaron Fox from day one. And Fox responded to it. He came in day one preaching about how good Fox would be defensively, and Fox's growth defensively over these last 2.5 years has been exponential. Because he held Fox to that standard. And Mike's belief was if he coached Fox and Domas as hard as he possibly can, harder than anybody else, that everybody else would have to fall in line or would have to follow because of the accountability that started at the top. If those guys were willing to do it, and I understand it may have rubbed people the wrong way, but he also finally got results out of this roster. Granted, it was a relatively new roster when he took over, the amount of changes that Monty McNair made that offseason when he was first hired. But it's, I hear what you're saying, Casey, 100%. I just think that painting a narrative that Mike found the negative or found the wrong in every single player and focused on that, I think is 100% false.
Every player, but think of all the sit here and think about all the players that didn't do something he didn't like and wouldn't play. Terrence Davis, Sasha, Davion, Keon, Kevin.
Half those guys are out of the league right now. They're not NBA players, or they're not right now. Clearly people agree with him. Okay. Terrence Davis hasn't had a job since he left Sacramento.
He tore his Achilles. Stop with this Terrence Davis slander.
I like TD, but
Metsu is one of those guys. Alex Lynn is one of those guys.
Not in the league. Alex Lynn, yeah.
All I'm saying is, I think that was. It's not something that he did like continuously to the detriment of everybody, but like he did it.
I can't remember if he played for him or not, but I think you're missing one of the best examples. But again, I can't remember if he played for Mike.
Who's that?
I think he did. Keita. Keita
did play for Mike. Yeah.
Namias is...
One year.
Namias is a good ball player. He just couldn't... Mike couldn't figure out how to get him on the floor. And that, and to Casey's point, that is actually something that frustrates me too. With Mike, and I would say it in real time. Like I don't understand you constantly talk about NBA teams like, oh, they found this diamond in the rough. Oh, they found this guy. They found that guy. Well, the Kings found Keon Ellis, and Mike was like, I kind of want a better version of Keon Ellis, bro. You don't have one. Like you found Keon. Mm-hmm. Like thank God you found Keon. Find a way to utilize this, and he couldn't. Like the situational role player, situational bench player that he dropped after that first DMP was like, man, that's crazy to me. Absolutely crazy.
The biggest problem with Mike Brown was he was stubborn. I think that was the biggest issue with Mike. Mike was firm in his convictions and stubborn to waver. Doesn't mean he didn't waver. He was stubborn with things that his coaches brought to him suggesting he should do. But Mike was very, very firm in what he believed this team had to do. Stubborn to the point of, as we talked about last year, the emphasis on defense taking too much away from the offense. When Mike would look you in the eye and he would tell you, I'm okay sacrificing a little bit of the offense for the defense to improve. In theory, he's correct. The problem is he sacrificed far too much offense at that time. But Mike also laid out for the media and shared with us before that that doesn't mean that he just punted on offense. Doesn't mean that they only drilled defense and then walked away. They still worked primarily on offense. In practice, he was asking for the same thing that Monty McNair took the podium after drafting Devin Carter and said, we are looking to fill this roster with guys that can do it on both ends of the floor. That is what Mike demanded out of every single one of his players. You are not going to be a one-trick pony. If you are, you're not playing. That was what Mike expected. So if you only did it on one end, even if he was a defensive coach, hey, look at what Kessler Edwards does on the defensive end. Kessler Edwards couldn't hit water if he fell out of a boat from three-point range. So Kessler Edwards didn't play. KZ Okpala got the starting opportunity, was a black hole on offense, did not play. That's what Mike did. Mike enforced looking for two-way players, and he didn't have enough of them on this roster to the fault of the front office. He had too short a leash with some guys like Keon Ellis, which is inexcusable to me, and he explained his reasons why, and I don't buy it, or I never really followed it. So he's not been perfect, but Mike held this organization to a standard higher than, hey, we'll score a bunch of points and maybe make it out of the first round. Mike had a higher bar than that, and he stuck to that, and it cost him his job.
He hasn't even made it back to the first round yet. Like, that's
100% fair. 100% fair.
And I'm a Mike Brown fan, but it's like, I don't. Matt, there's a reason that this season is where it's at. And I'm not saying at all that the reason is Mike Brown. I'm saying we've all been around this long enough. Everyone listening has been fans long enough. When you have expectations and things go this south, something has to change. The easiest change is the head coach. But just because it's easiest doesn't mean that it's the wrong one. Unfortunately, I don't think we have the answer to this yet, but it feels like there was a disconnect between Mike and the players, and that is not something that was birthed this season. It feels like something that started to take shape last year. Once the newness had worn off, once the, hey, guys, we did it, we broke playoff streak, all of this, beam, great, 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 great. It felt like, well, it started that second season. We all believe that the Chris Duarte, Kevin Huerter thing was a fumble. I used the term entitled all of last year when watching that basketball team play. I thought they were entitled. That falls on Mike. And here we are.
Not to interrupt both of you guys, but now I'm thinking, didn't Sabonis say five games in? We came in here doing things different than last year.
I don't know if it was five games in, but yeah.
It was 100%. After they lost three in a row. And
we had to have a talk.
Yeah, and Jake, he told Jake to shut the hell up.
Well, he didn't tell him that, but that's kind of what he told him.
But he was like, yeah, we had to have a talk because we came in here and just completely wiped out the things that worked last year.
Oh, yeah, Domas, what did you guys talk about?
Don't worry about it.
Exactly what he said.
And it's like, yeah, we just wiped out all the stuff that worked out last year for whatever reason. Like, why did we do that?
Yeah.
For what? Mike Brown's got a lot of good qualities as a coach, as a head coach. He does. But I do think he was part of the problem. He wasn't the problem, but he was part of the problem.
I agree with that. I don't think it's not fair to say anybody is the problem completely. It's also not fair to say anybody is not part of the problem or absolved of blame. 100%. Mike takes ownership and takes blame for it. My biggest issue with the firing is exactly what you said, though, D'Lo. I believe Mike Brown lost his job because it's easy. I think Mike Brown lost his job because of the circumstances, not because he wasn't good at his job. And that's what bothers me the most, because I mean, this is just the, I guess, the way it is for coaches in the NBA. And Mike Malone said the same thing when speaking up in support of Mike at his press conference, Mike Brown. Like, just because your front office is harder to move on from doesn't mean that they deserve to keep their job. They don't. Like, I think Monty McNair and Wes Wilcox deserve to lose their job because they decided, with the exception of the DeMar DeRozan move, they decided to essentially stay put and be patient. And while they've been patient, other teams have taken pieces they could use and retooled and jumped them in the West. They did that. They've recognized a problem and not addressed it. This team is undersized at every single position. One thing KC says that I think is 100% true is this roster as built is better than what we've seen this season. And they should be without any upgrade, 100%. But clearly, this team is plagued by the same issues as last season, which the front office has not addressed. And at the same time, I do worry, again, it's easier to get rid of a coach, much easier than it is to get rid of players, and your roster is kind of what it is. But I don't give a pass or a handout to the players who quit on Mike Brown or who refused to play hard under Mike Brown because they did not like him. If that's who you are, I don't want you here. I don't want you on my team. You're soft. If that's who you are. Because people are pointing out, look how hard they played for Doug Christie last night. They've been capable of playing that way for Mike Brown. Now, motivation, whatever the reasons, I'm sure, positive, that Doug did things different last night than Mike Brown would have done in those circumstances and in those instances. So I'm not going to say blanket black and white statement. But I do believe that, one, it's pretty common we see after a coach gets fired and an interim steps up. Usually players play hard for that interim coach. We saw it years ago. I have a vivid memory in my mind of, I'm pretty sure after, was it Paul Westphal was fired? Was it Kenny Natt that took over for Paul Westphal? If I'm not mistaken, it was Kenny Natt. Or is either Kenny Natt or Keith Smart?
I think it was Keith Smart.
I'm not even trying to live Smart. In this era again. What are we doing
Sorry.
Right now?
But I remember because the Kings won their Keith first Smart. Game after that happened. And there's a picture of Mike Brown hugging either Keith Smart or Kenny Natt. I think it was Keith Smart. Giving them this big old hug and they have these big smiles on their faces. How good was that team? They were terrible. That era sucked. So players typically play harder for an interim head coach, especially one that's as well-liked as Doug Christie is. But if it ever came out that the players chose not to play as hard as they should have and as hard as they are expected to for Mike, but they're playing now for Doug, I don't think
that's a thing.
People are making it out to be, well, again, as an argument against Mike, which, well, it shouldn't be an argument, period.
I think the only thing you can point to, and we see this in sports, is the Indiana game. They didn't make the decision to not play hard before the Indiana game started. They were getting their ass kicked, and when it came time to, like, scratch and claw, like they did last night in the fourth quarter, they just quit. Mm-hmm. You saw it. Like, it was... It happened at home. Like, it happened in front of 17,000 of your paying patrons. Like, this team sure. just quit. That's why we thought Mike... We alluded to it on Sports Sunday all night. I'm sorry. We alluded to it on this unnamed television show we were on all night that we thought Mike would be fired. Sorry, Matt.
Believe it or not, I missed that. Sorry, I didn't know that context.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, I thought Mike was getting fired after the Pacers game. And when he didn't, it was like, okay, they're going to see this thing through. And they just waited a little longer, that's all.
I think, from what I understand, the plan was to see it through. As far as I understand, the plan was to keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the few parts of the Ramona Shelburne article that I read from the league source side of things that I didn't completely roll my eyes at. But I do believe they were 100% trying to make it work. Because I don't believe the organization is dumb. They're not dumb. These are very bright people. Very bright people from ownership all the way down. I know they know how this is going to look. I know they know how this is going to come off. What I don't think they... took into account, though, fully is how their past would carry weight into a decision like this and how well respected Mike is around the league for the things that he's done. So I do believe they were trying to make it work. And I left the Pistons game thinking the Kings are going to make a mistake and fire Mike Brown after this game. Sure. But I think we all could feel it after the way that game ended. And some people saw Mike Brown's post-game press conference after that game as going out in a blaze of glory. I don't think it was. I think that was Mike Brown doing what he would have done, the same thing if he had full job security in the world. I think he knew exactly what he was doing in calling out De'Aaron Fox like that. And I think Fox is maybe the guy in that locker room that has responded to that better than anybody else. I also believe wholeheartedly that Fox had nothing to do with this firing. I believe that with every ounce of my being. There is no reason to believe that. There are no signs that point to that. It does not make sense that that is the case. So I don't believe that that press conference should have weighed into the decision of Mike being fired. How the game ended, I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back, and I said as much on the podcast. I still think the wrong decision was made, but the reality is it's been made. Now the Kings can hopefully try and move on. And here we are in a situation where, even though this team is still 4 games under .500 and I still has a lot of work to do, with the way the West is, they're still in it and they got a lot of time. So
as tough as the West is on paper, they have they've kind of given teams like the Kings and the Suns and the Warriors an opportunity to
might
stay
be tough,
alive.
But there's openings.
Yeah, to stay alive, because there's a lot of teams that are in the same relative area as far as not running away from things. So you still have that going for you guys, or for the Kings. Let me ask you guys a question. You tell me which one is worse. If Vivek wanted to fire Mike Brown and Monty said, I don't think we should, and Vivek said, fire him anyway, or if Vivek wanted to keep Mike Brown, but Monty said, I think we should fire him, and Vivek listened to Monty.
You're asking what's worse? Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, the first one's worse. Mm-hmm. The first one's worse. Because, and I say that because the second one, I don't think would ever happen.
Why not?
Well, actually, you did put the caveat there at the end that Vivek listened to Monty, but I don't. Again, I go off of history, I go off to track records, and I'm a big believer of actions speak louder than words. When a lot of people are talking, what do the actions say? Actions of the history of this ownership suggest the exact opposite to that scenario. So I would not believe that would be the case, but I would absolutely say that Vivek going over Monty, which we have no idea if this happened or not, but Vivek going over Monty and firing Mike, or forcing Monty to fire Mike, I think would be, I mean, we're talking now, that's just step one to the front office being fired and a full reset happening, which maybe needs to happen.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't think people can make up their mind on who fired Mike Brown. It's fascinating.
And I don't know. It goes back to what we always say, right? Like, we always talk about it. And I'm not saying Matt is doing this, but it's just what happens. When something good happens, Vivek got out the way. When something bad happens, he overstepped. Mm. Like, it's the same thing. Like, the fact that it's inconceivable that Vivek was like, I don't really want to do this. But Monty was like, I think this is what you need to do. And Vivek said, I'm going to let basketball people do basketball things.
But has he earned that? Has he earned that belief? The skepticism is based off of his own history, his past.
But like I said, like we talked about this a number of times. Whenever it's bad, it is always the same thing. Whenever it's good, it's not. Like, even down to the Mike Brown hire. Vivek didn't want Mike Brown. He wanted Mark Jackson.
But let's be realistic. We're only talking about one person. That's all we're talking about. Because we're talking about Michael Malone. We're not talking. Someone make the argument to me that Alvin Gentry, Luke Walton, whoever the hell else has coached this team since he took over, make the argument that any of them should have kept their jobs.
I think there's more than, well.
Okay, you would.
Their jobs, sure. I do think there.
I mean, Dave Yeager, should Dave Yeager have kept his job?
I think, I mean, we all know how that went down with other issues with members of the front office and having to draw sides and pick sides in that sense.
And,
but
and real quick, Matt, just to be fair about it, man, what's the story behind Mike Malone being fired? Pete wanted him gone and wanted George Karl in. But that never gets brought up.
So what the consistent sounds like is that Vivek hires the wrong basketball people.
That's what it sounds like.
And Monty and Wes, maybe. Well, I think anytime you hire a dual general manager, anytime you hire someone who interviewed for the job that they didn't get and just go, oh, be his assistant. Yeah, I think that's a little sketchy.
Mm.
But tell us about Devin Carter before we lose all our time.
Poor Devin Carter. We've never talked about him.
We try. Like, you saw him on Saturday. There are rumors all over the place. He may play as soon as tomorrow. There's rumors all over the place. He may play in Brooklyn. What was your takeaway watching Devin Carter this weekend?
He was red hot shooting the basketball. And I don't mean this in a negative way, but I think it kind of masked how he was playing.
Okay.
Watching him in person, I think he was playing at about 70-75%. From what we believe Devin Carter to be and what we saw Devin Carter looked at Devin Carter as coming into the league and when the Kings drafted him, that what we saw in the Golden One Center was not that version of Devin Carter. Mm. Devin Carter was not known as a guy who's going to hit, what did he hit, 4 threes or 5 threes? And that's not Devin Carter, or from what we understand Devin Carter. If he can get hot like that, fan-freaking-tastic. But that's not who the Kings drafted. The Kings drafted a two-way, energetic, harassing defender who will run up and down the floor, play with pace, and he showed flashes of that. Now, I have realistic expectations. It was his first game back after shoulder surgery, so I wasn't expecting to see that version of Devin Carter. But I just caution fans. He scored 29 points. He did what he was supposed to do. He dominated the G League. NBA players dominate in the G League. He did what he was supposed to do. But the way he played is not consistent with how he played in college. So I was excited to see it, happy to see it. His finishing around the rim was really, really good. He tried to get downhill. The jump shot looks weird, but it goes in, so who cares? Or at least it did on that given day. But what makes Devin Carter, that energy, that hustle, we did not really get to see that beyond short bursts because he looked gassed because it was his first real game action. And he was moving his shoulder a lot too, trying to make sure everything was okay. And he talked about, because he's had the same exact surgery on his other shoulder, which I think is his right shoulder. And he said when he had it in high school, it kind of spooked him a little bit because he can hear popping and crunching. He can hear cartilage breaking, and that's what he told us. So I think it was a test, and he aced it. He aced his first test. But who we saw inside the Golden One Center, I don't think is fully accurate to who Devin Carter is as a player. He's not going to come into Sacramento and suddenly start for the Kings and score 29 points and go 6 of whatever from 3-point range. He's not going to do it. But if he can be that, I think that's even more than what we expected. Or if he can do that from time to time, that's even more than what we expected coming into the league.
Great stuff, Matthew. Great, great stuff. It's been a busy couple of days for you for sure. We appreciate all of the great work you do over there on ABC 10 and, of course, Locked On Kings.